I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS News Radio. And it's a great pleasure to welcome my longtime colleague, friend, and informant of matters to do with the United States Navy, Captain Jerry Hendricks, U.S. Navy aviator retired, who is the author of a new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, subtitle, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry, congratulations for the book. And we begin with our conversation with threat. You have asked, and the 65th Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, has generously remarked upon your book as a foreword. And in it, Mr. Layman uses this historical analogy to explain the present challenge for the U.S. Navy to do with the Pacific Ocean. He says that it is wise to think of the Western Pacific, that would be East Asia, that would be the People's Republic of China, the Western Pacific as the inner German border, referring to the 20th century. What does that mean, Jerry? How does that explain the threat and the challenge for the U.S. Navy in the 21st century? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and thank you again for having me on. It's great to join you in your new venue here. I think what Secretary Layman is talking about there, and as he contextualizes within his, as you said, very, very kind foreword to the book, is he's talking both strategically and geographically. So the inner German border during the Cold War was where the battle of ideas in so many ways was being played out. And we can remember the idea of the Berlin Wall, and we can also remember the fixation with the Fulda Gap as an area of high vulnerability for the Western alliance against the Warsaw Pact nations. That was where the competition would be played out if it went to war, but it was also where the competition was being played out in the Cold War peacetime environment in sort of an arena of ideas, the idea of Western democracies and capitalism going up against the Eastern communist countries and their particular form of economic coercion. And so when we pivot and we look at our current competition, specifically vis-a-vis China, then the Western Pacific becomes the place where those battle of ideas, the idea of the centrally controlled economy, the idea of the central authoritarian state, which the Chinese are promoting both within their own country as well as trying to get the subservience of all the other nations, the Western Pacific, to bow to them and their wishes. But it also would be the location of where a war would play out if it went to that place. So wars are determined in so many ways by both the capabilities and capacity of the opposing sides, but wars are also dependent upon the geography. And so the Western Pacific has some very specific geography that will funnel and create points of conflict that we can sort of recognize and anticipate. So I think Secretary Layman has correctly identified that the Western Pacific is the area of competition for the future, and he is right to put our lens upon that.
A civilian such as myself might think to this problem, hey, it's the ocean. Anybody can go there. You can't stop it. There are no walls, and the weather comes and the weather goes, and if you're floating across a vast expanse, who's going to stop you, and who's going to dominate that vast expanse? As Marcus Aurelius taught us, you can't put your foot in the same river twice. Same for the ocean. However, what I learned from Jerry's book is that the presumed open ocean is a construction of the Enlightenment. It wasn't always this way. The Romans dominated the Middle Sea 2,000 years ago, but let's speak to the conflict that Jerry identifies, because his book is part historical background and part projection of what is needed into the future. We go to the early 17th century, an incident between the Portuguese and the ambition of the Dutch. What happened, Jerry, and what did we learn from that? What did a philosopher named Grotius learn from that?
Well, it's a great place to start, because what happens in this conversation, this intellectual conversation, then goes on to inform the very basic foundational concepts of the Enlightenment, which in turn, you know, formed the United States and most of the Western world today. But to flashback, there was a point in time when the oceans were divided by papal decree between Portugal and Spain. And so one portion of the world was ruled by Portugal, had been deeded to it virtually by treaty, and the other part was retained to Spain. That, of course, would not stand as the Protestant republics rose, and the Dutch and the British came to the fore and began their own areas of exploration and commercial development. They began to sail on, quote, Portuguese and Spanish seas. And so this became an area of legal contention. There was a point in time when a Dutch ship seized a Portuguese ship that was operating ostensibly in Portuguese waters, at least as defined by the church. And so the Dutch seized the goods of this ship. The goods were quite valuable. In fact, it was essentially worth the value of the cost to run a government, the Dutch government at least, for a year. But then the Portuguese sued them in court. And Hugo Grotius was hired by the Dutch East India Company to essentially defend their claim. And Grotius does a wonderful thing, which is he actually loses the case for his client. The Dutch actually have to return the value of the goods to the Portuguese. But what he does is he makes an argument for what he terms as the free sea, which is that there is nothing in natural law, which is to say the law of nature in, as observed by man that we ascribe to God. And he says that there is nothing that stops the flow of a movement of a ship as it moves through the winds and the currents, you know, across the ocean. And so there's not even a natural barrier like a mountain range or a river that you would have on land. And so he comes up with this construct of the free sea. And he says that that which cannot be abridged by God cannot be abridged by man. And so this idea of the right of a free sea to have free trade unencumbered across the oceans is essentially comes down in this legal decision, which Grotius calls mare clausum, or I'm sorry, mare librum, which is the open or free sea. There's a countering school called mare clausum, which is that there is a closed sea, but that argument loses. And so the free sea becomes foundational then to just a few decades later to the idea of individual liberty and individual freedom. So as things can flow evenly or across the ocean, then mankind can flow, and the idea of the individual movement across, so long as it doesn't impinge upon others, their rights or their desires, then no individual should be, their movement should not be abridged. And so this concept of freedom sort of grows out of it and informs the way that we view the world today, at least in the terms of the Western Enlightenment. And so this understanding of the free sea is very critical to understanding what it is that we, in the United States and the Western world today, have built over the last 70 years. Because the fact is that for much of the last four centuries, since Grotius came down with this idea in 1609, the seas were not free. There was piracy. There was navies that were claiming vast portions of the sea. And there was many, many battles fought over these ideas. But slowly but surely, these ideas became cemented into essentially the Western canon. Now, really, really comes to culmination is after 1945 and the Great War in the Pacific and in the Atlantic, where finally the United States and its allies emerge very much triumphant. So triumphant that the U.S. has 6,000 ships and the British have some 1,800 ships. And there's virtually no other competitors on the world's oceans. And so in that environment, the number of battles goes to zero, virtually. There's been less than 30 battles over the last 70 years. But it's the ideas that prevail, and the idea of free and unencumbered trade back and forth across the world has had a dramatic effect upon the lives of man worldwide, as we see just a dramatic uptick in global economic production and a dramatic decrease in things like extreme poverty and even illiteracy. So post-1945 is a world that's been created by the free sea, in which the United States has sort of really labored over the last 70 years to build and then defend.
I'm speaking with Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy aviator retired. His new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry's just taken us on a tour of 400 years. When we come back, lessons learned in those 400 years that apply today to the contest between the United States Navy and the PLA, the People's Liberation Army Navy, in the Western Pacific. That's the geostrategic area that is in question here, the Western Pacific, the first string of islands, the second string of islands, all the way out to the third string of islands. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS Radio News. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. My colleague, Captain Jerry Hendricks, is the author, Captain Jerry Hendricks, of a new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry's now outlined the last 400 years since a philosopher attorney, Grotius, very carefully constructed what we understand as a free sea, a free ocean, for commerce, for prosperity, for people of the earth to grow rich and happy and watch their grandchildren prosper. However, there have been caveats in between that are pertinent to here in the 21st century about operating close to land or near enough to land so that the issue is, what is the territory, what is the claim of the sea of the territory, and how far out does it go, and what can you do about people that may or may not challenge your claim. Jerry, what is the cannonball rule that developed in these last 400 years?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one of the most interesting historical questions, but it has dramatic implications for us in the world today. So at the time that Hugo Grotius was making his claim of the free sea, there were a number of entities, including the British and even some voices within the Dutch body politic that said, no, we don't want a free sea. In fact, we want to extend territorial claims over large portions of the oceans so that we can control them almost as if they were territory. But the pushback was is that you cannot really control, you cannot claim what you cannot control. So there was an argument that said that unless you can exercise persistent military control over the sea, then you cannot claim it. And so there was this carve-out that was made in sort of the free sea theory, which is that of the territorial sea. In the beginning, this territorial sea was ruled by what we called the two-cannon-shot rule, which was that because there was going to be an expectation of the increase of a capability, they would figure out how far a cannonball could shoot out at sea. And then they would double that, expecting that perhaps they would be able to extend the range of their cannons in the future. And that ever, however far that was, then that was your territorial sea, because you could control that sea as if it was your territory from your land. And so this became that first carve-out. And so we had this idea of territorial seas. In the beginning, it was about 2 nautical miles. Now the territorial sea claims generally, you know, range between 8, in some cases, 12 nautical miles becomes a standard. There's also a 14 nautical mile claim. But this is as far as this has gone, is essentially these types of short distances away from land that nations can claim as their territorial seas. Now, there are some other things that have come up recently, such as extended economic zones, but those are not sovereign territory. The waters within your territorial seas are treated as if they were your territorial land. But here recently, several states, China and Russia being the leaders of them, have sought to begin to extend these claims. And they've been doing that for a couple reasons. I'll just roll back post-Cold War as the beginning point of this. After the Cold War ended, 1989, 1990, the United States fought a dramatic campaign against Iraq's incursion into Kuwait. And won rather overwhelmingly, and won with the use of new capabilities such as stealth, GPS-driven precision strike weapons, and quite frankly, just some outstanding maneuvering of land forces. And this shocked countries such as Russia and China. They looked at that and saw what the United States had done with regard to regime change strategies, and they feared that that was going to happen to them. China's fears were heightened just a few years later when there was a Taiwan Strait crisis where China was trying to intimidate the government on Taiwan not to elect a political party that was more in favor of independence for that island nation than the other party. And so they tried to launch some missiles as a means of intimidating. And the United States sailed a carrier strike group through the Taiwan Strait and then put an amphibious strike group with Marines through that strait as well. And this embarrassed the Chinese, caused them to lose face. And so the Chinese began to invest in a series of weapons, which we now call anti-access air denial weapons, in an effort to push the United States farther and farther away from its shores. Its thoughts is if the United States cannot get close enough to be able to project power into our country, then they would not be able to affect a regime change. And so, and Russia has done similar investments as well with missiles and radars and sensors and aircraft. And what's happened is, flash forward 30 years, and what we've seen is the Chinese have made a territorial sea claim over the South China Sea. They've made hints of claims over portions of the East China Sea. And Russia has made vast territorial sea claims over portions of the Arctic Ocean to its far north. All of these things run counter to the concept of the free sea. And all of them, if they're left allowed to stand and become precedent, could really undermine the global system of trade that the United States and its allies have labored so long to build. And so this is the challenge we face today, is that China is essentially saying, hey, look, you know, the original territorial sea claim was based upon how far you could project your power from shore to control the sea and to be able to have a military impact upon the sea, the two cannon shot rule. Well, my cannon shots today are long-range anti-ship missiles that can reach thousands of miles out into the ocean, or short-range cruise missiles that go hundreds of miles out into the ocean. So if I can do that, am I not upholding your Western law of territorial sea claims? Can I not just amend it and update it for the modern aspects of today's with the weapon system sensors that we have today? And that's the challenge that we're facing as a Navy, and really as, you know, a Western civilization today, is these extended territorial sea claims and their impacts.
Jerry, quickly, what is the Freedom of Navigation operation, and how does it connect to this claim that the sea is owned and the ability of the U.S. to say, no, it's not, it's a free sea? We have 2 minutes, Jerry. Go ahead.
So the United States, you know, first of all, it's not just China, it's not just Russia. In fact, there's a number of nations that go and make these sort of excessive territorial sea claims, or what we call excessive baseline claims, where they try to redraw the maps on what is their territorial seas. The United States, in an effort to counter that, we have sort of a standard routine of places that we're going to go and sail our U.S. Navy ships, and we will sail them through these waters that have been excessively claimed in order to demonstrate that, no, that is not your territorial sea, this is the free sea, and I will demonstrate that by sailing my warship through these waters. And if you choose to come out and try to stop me, then that could lead to conflict, and then you raise the question with them, is that what you want? Do you want to have a conflict with the United States and its Navy at sea? And for much of the last 70 years, no one has wanted to do that. But the problem today, John, is because of what has been going on with our investments in our Navy, people are beginning to look at these areas and deciding to come out and perhaps challenge the United States. But yes, freedom of navigation operations, such as what we do in the South China Sea near these artificial islands or up in the Arctic, is there to demonstrate the U.S. believes that these to be free seas, and then are moved to demonstrate that they are in fact free seas by sailing our ships through them.
Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy, aviator, retired. The book is To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. What Navy do we need when we come back? What do we have now? What do we need? And what is the right mix for the challenge of the 21st century? I'm John Batchelor. This is the New John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the New John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS News Radio. It's a pleasure to continue a conversation with my colleague, Jerry Hendricks, the author Jerry Hendricks of To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy, asking the question, what Navy do we need? Or as Jerry puts it very plainly, what is the correct mix? Jerry, how would you characterize the mix of the U.S. Navy today at under 300 ships? What is its mission, and can it adequately supply what is needed in this changing world?
Thank you, John, and great questions once again. So the Navy has two essential roles that it has to do on a day-to-day basis. And in one of those missions or roles is unique to the U.S. Navy, which is the requirement to provide a persistent naval presence around the world. No other force, the Air Force, the Army, has a requirement to be persistently forward deployed in order to uphold American interests. And this approach isn't unique to the United States in history. The British did this. The Romans did this, where they would use their navies to uphold their interests. But for right now, the United States is sort of the ruling cop on the beat in the world on the idea of upholding rules and norms. And so we need a fairly substantial navy in order to be persistently out there. In fact, we need about 150 ships to be at sea on any given day in order to satisfy all of the presence requests and requirements that have been identified by our regional combatant commanders. And by that, I mean things like the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, or the Indo-Pacific combatant commander that's out in Honolulu, or the Southcom commander that's down in Miami. These people identify places that they need U.S. Navy ships to sail in order to demonstrate American interest and resolve. And so if you add all those things up, it comes up to be between 130 and 150 ships on any given day. Unfortunately, we only have about 297 ships today, which means that we would either have to have over half of our fleet at sea in every given moment, or we have to compromise and sort of cut back. And in order to keep our fleet in good maintenance and our crews trained, we've begun to compromise and cut back on those persistent forward deployments. That has created these power vacuums around the world, which is, you know, places like the South China Sea or in the Arctic, where the U.S. has very little presence up there. And the Russians and the Chinese have sought to fill those vacuums. So what type of Navy? So that's the presence mission.
Let me explicate a little more, because I'm learning from you, Jerry.
Yeah.
The Navy, as I understand it, amateur reader here, is built around its supercarriers, 10 Nimitz-class supercarriers and one new Ford-class supercarrier. It is supported by ships called cruisers, Ticonderoga-class,
yeah,
and perhaps also destroyers, Arleigh Burke-class, and submarines, attack submarines. All of that is in support. That describes the Navy we have today. And if I read the news correctly, it's exhausted. It can't be everywhere at once, especially because it has demands in the Gulf, demands in the Western Pacific, as we've identified. And then there also is something you've taught me, that the Russians are increasingly sophisticated about sorting their submarines out of the northern seas into the Atlantic. All those demands upon the Navy. And your analysis is that the Navy is always changing. It never stands still. It needs more ships, but it needs a new mix of ships. Now, before we go to the new mix, what is the mission of the supercarrier today, those 10 Nimitz-class carriers and their air wings? How are they challenged by the present geopolitical contest?
Okay, and so that goes to the second major mission of the Navy. So I mentioned there's two missions. One's provide day-to-day presence to sort of preserve the peace. The second mission, major mission of the Navy, is the win-the-war capability of the fleet, the ability that if an enemy chooses to go to war with the United States, that we have the capability and capacity to win that war decisively and hopefully quickly. And so the U.S. Navy is focused on its supercarrier fleet for most of the last 70 years to be the central part of that win-the-war part of the fleet structure. We also depend upon our submarines, which are also very lethal and very decisive in warfare. And so when you start looking at this question of the mix, you need to have a good balance between that day-to-day preserve the peace force, which I generally ascribe that to frigates and other small craft to provide presence at a lower cost, with a balance with your high-end warfighting capability, which I tend to ascribe that to our carriers and their escorts within the carrier strike groups, as well as our submarines, our fast attack submarines, and our guided missile submarines. And so we've gotten out of balance because, one, we've become very top-heavy. We have a lot of war-winning capability within the fleet. We do have 11 supercarriers in the fleet today. We have 22 cruisers. We have nearly 90 Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. But we have very little capacity in terms of frigates or small surface combatants to do that day-to-day presence. And so as we look towards the future, what is the mix we want to build? We want to get that balance back by, you know, growing the number of frigates in our fleet. But at the same time, we need to make some deep investments in a new large surface combatant to escort our carriers, because our Ticonderoga-class cruiser is about to retire. But we also need to make some investments in some new things. You know, recently, large unmanned surface vessels, these unmanned platforms that can be out there without any men on them but still carry tremendous capabilities in terms of sensors or weapons that can work in cooperation with manned ships, those are areas where we need to make some significant investments going forward, because that allows us to grow the fleet, perhaps at a lower cost, because the unmanned platforms will not cost as much as a manned platform, but also create a platform that we can send into very dangerous settings that perhaps we don't want to send a manned platform. So this is all about trying to find the right mix or balance of our future fleet structure.
How does Moneyball, the wonderful baseball book about getting players that can get on bases, how does that inform the challenge for the U.S. Navy?
Well, you know, John, I had to include that into the book because I found it so intriguing. I read that book, and of course, much as you, I love baseball, grew up watching baseball, grew up watching the big red machine of the Cincinnati Reds in the 1970s. And so one of the things that, you know, the Moneyball book suggests is that getting on base is the most important thing or metric to really study. It's not the home run hitter. It's the guy who can get on base, either through a single, a walk, or getting hit by a pitch, because getting on base provides the potential to score. And if he's followed by another player who can also get on base and hence move him over, then you're going to be able to ultimately generate runs. So what is that balance between the base hitter who can get on and perhaps steal and the big home run hitter that you're going to put in the number three or number four, a hole in the batting order? That's the thing that I took away from this. We need to have the number of small surface combatants, the frigates, the base hitters, you know, in our lineup, but you also need to have that home run hitter there that's also part of the balance. I just found the Moneyball analogy to be so useful because it made me think of the Navy in a different way, and I hope that as I explained it within the book, that it would cause the reader, perhaps a reader who's not familiar with the Navy, to kind of come to grips with the idea of presence, which in many ways is nebulous. But if you think of presence as the guy getting on base, then perhaps that becomes something that you can understand.
The frigates, you've mentioned them several times, Jerry, and we'll build frigates. We've got a new contract to the FREM, which stands for, not obviously, Frigate European Multi-Mission. You describe this FREM as a pickup truck as opposed to a weapon system. What does that mean, Jerry, for the fleet?
Well, you know, I think it was time after some of the ships that we've had that had setbacks. They were technical failures. The Zumwalt class is still struggling. The Ford class aircraft carrier is still struggling because of the number of technologies that were incorporated into their designs and that have not fully matured. And so I looked at the FREM as saying, this is a really basic utility ship that I can put new sensors or new weapons on fairly easily, or take them off fairly easily as the design matures over its 25 to 30 year life. The FREM that gets commissioned in a few years as the new Constellation class frigate will not look like the Constellation, the USS Constellation would look at the end of her life 30 years hence. You would be able to put new radars on her, perhaps new sensors, undersea sonars, and new missiles that design would change over life. So think of it more as your utility pickup truck. You know, when I go to the woods of Maine, you know, with my truck, You know, I go up there, maybe I take my chainsaw today, maybe I have to take another tool with me tomorrow, but I depend on what is the mission that I have today that tells me what I'm going to put in the back end of that truck before I go either into the woods or in my ship as I go out to sea.
The Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, we're building new frigates, I understand, and they're like a toolkit that you can call upon, like a Swiss Army knife. But the Arleigh Burke destroyers, I've come to understand as battleships. We have 21 of them you identify that need to be updated. Is that a wise investment, Jerry, to update things that are about the Cold War?
Well, the one thing about it is, so you have the 21, what we call the Flight 1 Arleigh Burkes. They were the first 21 ships of that design that were built. And they're coming up that we're going to have to make a decision that we either retire them and send them to the breakers or use them as targets in some of our exercises, or we're going to have to make a significant investment to upgrade them. The first 21 Arleigh Burkes did not come, for instance, with a helo hangar. It was a mistake, which is why we built the next flight of the Arleigh Burkes that included a helicopter hangar on them. But these first 21 ships, if we took them in and invested in refurbishing their hulls, strengthening their keels and their ribs, perhaps upgrading their power plant system, and then integrating perhaps a new missile like the new conventional prompt strike hypersonic missile so that this ship could bring a new capability to the fight, then those ships could have a new lease on life, and I may be able to use them for another 10 to 15 years rather than just scrap them now and send them away. Refurbishing them will cost us some money, but it would cost us less money than to build a new ship, you know, from the keel up. And so this is one of the things that I suggest as a means of getting to a larger fleet more quickly. And I think the quickness is an important aspect of this conversation, John. We do not have 20 years to prepare for the Chinese threat. Admiral Davidson, the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command, recently came back and said that he believed that we may have a fight over Taiwan within the next 6 years. And so the threat of China at sea is proximate and real, and it's something that we have to begin dealing with now.
Jerry, I don't want to speak against an admiral, but I think 6 years might be generous, Jerry. Generous. I can tighten that timeline given the rhetoric that's coming out of the Western Pacific. Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy aviator retired. The new book is to provide and maintain a Navy. Why naval primacy is America's first best strategy. When we come back, what will that day look like? How will our adversaries conduct themselves with their new capabilities? What can the U.S. Navy do about it? I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. It's a pleasure to speak Navy with a professional. Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy aviator retired. His new book is To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry, you have a moment of a projection of a conflict that looks unsolvable to me, an amateur. What it is it combines the closed sea, the Mare Clausum, the territorial sea, Mare Clausum, with the capability of the PLA Navy and the Russian Navy to force or challenge or back away U.S. Navy operations, a freedom of navigation operation, and say, don't come back, you're out of here, and they're covered by their land-based cruise missiles, their land-based missiles that are carrier killers or Guam killers. Right now, do we have an answer to that, Jerry, if it comes to physical confrontation in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, the Philippine Sea?
Well, I think we do, actually. And it's something that the last administration made abundantly clear to the Chinese and to the Russians in more ways than one. The Chinese economy is, unlike the American economy, is totally dependent on both external sources of raw resources as well as external markets. And by that, I mean that China is dependent upon the Middle East for its oil. It does not have enough coal or oil within its own borders to be able to run its economy autonomously. And so it has to bring that oil in from the Middle East or from other sources. And by and large, it has to come by ocean. They are building some pipelines over land, but those pipelines will not have the capacity to deliver the amount of oil per day that they need, oil or natural gas. Same thing on ores. China is not an ore or raw resources rich nation at this point in time in its history. And so, you know, China has to import raw resources from Africa, from Australia, as well as from South America. In fact, they've created an entire class of ore carriers, which they call China Max ore carriers, which are some of the largest ships in the world. All the ore that needs to flow to China essentially on a daily basis to feed that economy. Now, also, China lacks a middle class of sufficient size to have enough consumers to buy the goods that its factories produce. So it's dependent upon the West, the United States and Europe, largely to buy its finished goods. And so it is in a very critical point right now. So if China was to press home its advantages or to try and say, I claim the Western Pacific, then it faces the risk of the United States Navy interdicting its raw resource suppliers coming across the seas. Also, if the United States was to cut China off from those people who would buy its resources, that economy very quickly will run out of time. So it'll run out of money, and it runs out of time. And so this is the challenge. This is the vulnerability that they have that they're aware of. Russia also is dependent essentially on its energy export in order to keep its economy afloat, either over land or by sea. And right now that's one of the main reasons that the Russians are trying to keep the Arctic sea line, the northern sea lane, open year-round, because that sea lane carries energy from Russia to China to help fuel its economy. And so you see that this vulnerability for both states lies upon the ocean. Now, that vulnerability actually goes beyond just the commercial part of this. Both of them also fear the ideas that come, you know, the very notion of free trade, of trade that's kind of unencumbered by the state control, that doesn't prioritize based upon the state's wishes. Both of those countries fear that. And so understanding that free trade, free navigation is a threat to China, even as it supplies it with the basic materials it needs for its life, is an important understanding of sort of the philosophical debate that's ongoing. So the U.S. Navy has the tools in order to stop the economy of the Chinese at sea on any given day. And I think that's one of the basic questions we always ask is, how many ships can I sink in the first 72 hours? Is sort of a question that bounces around the think tanks of Washington, D.C., And I think the Chinese are paying attention to that very basic question.
We have a few minutes, Captain, so we go immediately to the end of your book when you provide a grid of what the fleet must, can, will, should look like in the year 2040 or 2050. What immediately comes to attention is that we now have zero frigates and we need 60. Also, submarines. I believe that the necessity is for an increase in attack submarines and their support ships, but largely non-existent right now are unmanned surface vessels, 18. So 18 unmanned surface vessels, 60 frigates, and an increase in the submarine fleet, the attack submarine fleet, particularly 6 to 62. Will that answer, Jerry? If we build that, 450, will that answer? We have a few minutes. We have 2 minutes.
I believe that it will answer, and in fact, if we begin to aggressively move towards these numbers of these types, then we're going to solve the problems, the challenges that we face in those two mission areas. If we grow the number of frigates and we grow the number of large unmanned surface vessels, then we will provide the naval presence that is required around the world to assure our allies and uphold our interests on a day-to-day basis much more cheaply and much more effectively than what we are right now. If we grow the number of attack submarines, and I also mentioned in there, John, the need for 8 guided missile submarines. You know, the 4 Ohio-class SSGNs, or guided missile submarines, are going to retire in the next 10 years, and we have no replacement for them, which means we're going to lose some 600 Tomahawk missiles in our submarine inventory over the next 10 years. I'd like to replace all of those Tomahawk missiles underwater with more of them. And so I would like to build more fast attack submarines, but I would also to replace those guided missile submarines as well. That gives us that war-winning lethality that we need, that's survivable, that can penetrate deep into these anti-access air denial environments. But the unmanned is really sort of the critical pivot point right now, because that's where I can actually grow the fleet, perhaps not as substantially more at cost. It will cost more overall, but not as much more if I wanted to grow to a 456 ship fleet just with all manned. And so unmanned sort of gives me a way of keeping some of my costs down going forward, and that's the reason I drew up this matrix. The other big point of this too, John.
We have 30 seconds, Jerry. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
We need a larger logistics force. If you're going to have more combatant ships at sea, if you're going to have five aircraft carriers, you need the oilers and the ammunition ships and the food supply ships that are out there to keep them all supplied. So we cannot forget the logistics force, which get built in different shipyards. So,
Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy aviator retired, to provide and maintain a Navy, why naval primacy is America's first best strategy. I'm John Bashaw.